Well, now we're joined by the Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien. Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thank you very much.
Let's talk about what happened yesterday, the big protest which went down to the Convention Centre, making the point that they want 100% redress for houses affected by mica, and a motion was passed in the House. What is the official government response to these demands?
Well, I met with the group, I think, just very briefly, Pat, if I could go back just a couple of months. I think most people entered into the scheme that was agreed early last year in good faith, and I think the scheme is the basis for how we move on. But there are changes needed, no question, and actually issues with how the scheme was actually operating in real life were raised with me in February. So I asked the groups to send me a submission, which they did at the end of April, the 29th of April. And since then, we've been engaging on specific issues around, you know, engineering costs, upfront costs, the contribution, the redress amount, all of those various things. So the contacts have been very constructive. I'm of a view that amendments do need to be made to the scheme, and we would have only found this out. It was a scheme brought in, as I said, over a year ago. Really, it's just when people start interacting with them where you can see where the issues arise. So what I proposed to the group yesterday, actually over the weekend, but formally yesterday when I wrote to them, is we would just set up a time-bound working group to meet between now and to conclude its work by the end of July, to work through those issues and to bring them to resolution. And I'm confident that we can do that. I visited homeowners in Donegal. It's an absolute scourge. Mica is just devastating. And particularly the pirate in the block and mica, where homes are literally crumbling. And it does need to be addressed.
Minister, you know, we will get a text, because we've got them already, from people saying, why is the state picking up the tab for this? There's a statutory instrument from 1949 which says 1% mica is permissible. The levels in Donegal are around 17%, you know, 17 times higher than the limit. These construction materials were not fit for purpose. The Taoiseach said other people were walking off the pitch. So there is a question, why is the state picking up the tab for private suppliers who supplied deficient materials?
It's a really valid question, and it's one that I intend to address. This happened with pyrite in the infill as well, where the pyrite remediation scheme on the East Coast, where both the, not just those who actually supplied it, but the bond insurers and others walked away. That was a scheme that was agreed in 2012, 2013, when it came into place. So we've actually asked the Attorney General to look at options here. I think there is a major issue around accountability and responsibility, and not just about the poor product that was supplied, but also about the response of other stakeholders. And I would say this around the insurers and the insurance sector, and also indeed the banking sector, Pat. And I say it for this reason. Many of the homes that will be fixed have mortgages on them. And those mortgages are seen as, and those properties are seen as assets that back up the mortgages by the banks. Now, the state will make those assets good because we want to help families and we want to help people. But I think there's an issue there for the banks to be looked at. They are party to this as well. That has to be dealt with, and I intend for us to do that. But in the short term,
are you saying, the banks, are you saying that because the banks insist on a survey, for example, and if they missed it, then they have responsibility? Is that your message to the banks?
I think that is part of it. I'd agree with what you've just said. I think they're also party to it. They do share a responsibility here, in my view, because they are a part owner of many of these properties. And I don't think it's a question that they can just stand by and just see the state fix it. Now, the state have a big role here, because what we're concerned about, when the Taoiseach visited Donegal on Thursday, and I've been talking to the groups right the way through the weekend, and as I said, I have visited families who've been suffering, is making their homes safe. And in many instances, we're going to have to replace homes. Of the 433 plus applications we've received so far into the existing scheme, about a third of those homes will have to be demolished. So that's how bad it is. And I think we have a situation whereby we probably have upwards of 5,000 homes, and it could be substantially more. So the state does need to leave options open for it to be recompensed by other stakeholders, yeah, if we can do that legally. And that's why we're getting...
Okay, well, I'm glad to know that you're interrogating the Attorney General in terms of what legal rights the state might have, not to be the taxpayer inevitably picking up the tab for everything. Because straight away we have a text in, what about the remediation works needed on so many apartment buildings which were constructed during the Celtic Tiger? You know, light touch regulation and so on. The state has walked away from those particular issues.
Well,
could the state not be...
a really good point, Pat, and sorry, excuse me for interrupting. In the programme for government that I was party to negotiating, we've given a commitment that in relation to fire defects and latent defects, that we would establish an expert group, which I've done, actually, which is up and running, that includes residents of apartments, like the Apartments Owners Network and the Construction Defects Alliance, who are actually working right now on proposals that they would bring forward. Again, this does lead the question, particularly around the bond insurers, about when is a structural problem something that they should deal with. Like, if you think about it, when you buy a new home, you have to buy a 10-year bond insurance. My experience has been that in those instances, in many cases, these insurers have not stepped up to the mark. So in the short term, it's people's safety that we need to ensure, and it's their own homes and make sure their homes are secure. But I'm closing no door in relation to what we can do to make sure that other stakeholders play their role financially. And if the state can then go after, so to say, those for some of those costs, I think we should. Because, you know, this isn't down to necessarily regulation. Some of the regulations are very strong. It's down to poor product, poor delivery of that product, and poor construction of that product. And that is the responsibility of those who actually delivered that product, and those homes or apartments. So I'm not forgetting
many
about
of them,
those
as we know,
apartment
you
owners.
Know, they collapsed, their companies collapsed, and they walked away, leaving the companies as limited entities, not having the resources to put things right. And then these guys start up again under a different company name, and off they go again, perhaps to do it right this time, but having done it wrong so many times. Anyway, just park that for a moment. There's another element which I know concerns you. And that is when you're buying either a new home or a second-hand home, and you go along, and the asking price, it's for sale, and the asking price is, say, $400,000. So you say, OK, I'll have that, I have the money, a bank has given me the thing, I'll pay you $400,000, and the guy says, well, actually, since we advertised that, I've had an offer of $420,000. Can you do any better? And you say, well, I'll give you $425,000, and then it goes up to 430, 440, and eventually at 440 you drop out. And then you get a call saying, oh, by the way, the fellow who ordered 450, who offered 450, he's pulled out, so now you're the top bidder. Will you buy it? And you wonder, were these bidders real at all? So I'm asking you this, is it appropriate when there are other options for estate agents, sale by tender, so sealed bids in envelopes, or sale by public auction with a reserve, or for sale? If it's for sale at a price, it should be buyable at that price. End of.
Yeah, look, these issues have been raised, and I'd say first and foremost that there are, pretty strict guidelines as to how bids operate and the transparency of those bids when people are buying a house.
No, but Minister, I know they'll say you can report them to whoever, the housing regulator, if you suspect a bid is not genuine. But the whole idea of advertising a house for sale at a price, and then that turns out not to be the price. I mean, if you advertise a second-hand car at a price, normally you negotiate it down, not up. But here we have estate agents negotiating upwards all the time, and that to me is sharp practice.
Well, look, what I would say firstly, you've raised that point that where people think sharp practice is in play, that can be reported to the Property Services Regulatory Authority and should be. Okay, what I would say as well is right now, because supply is so constrained, there is a very heavy demand there. And, you know, you can have very competitive bidding, particularly in the second-hand market. And that's why we need to get the increase of new homes up and up.
Minister, I think you're missing the point. You're missing the point because public auction is the way. If you want competitive bidding, public auction is the way. Or if you want to do it in a more orderly way, you do it by tender, sealed bids in an envelope. If you put something for sale, it's for sale. End of.
No, I understand completely the point that you're raising. what I would say as well, one area that I'm looking at, or have asked actually the Property Services Regulatory Authority to look at, is the whole issue of proof of funds, and where we've seen very recently some quite detailed information being sought by some selling agents, right down to the Help to Buy grant reference number, access code, you know, actually looking at people's bank statements. And I think that's far, far too invasive and isn't actually required. When we were in the middle of COVID restrictions, there was actually, to limit the number of people who would come and visit a property, there was a regulation brought in that proof of funds would have to be shown. But that simply means like your mortgage offer is showing that you have the requisite amount of money in the bank. But now it seems in some instances they've gone a further step. That's not something that that I support. I've been critical of that. It doesn't fall directly under my remit, Pat, just to say that. I have, though, written to the Property Services Regulatory Authority specifically on that issue. You raise a fair point with regard to offer for sale. I think when you're offering for sale as well, if someone else bids for it, that is an issue. Why I was mentioning that, the fact that of the competitive market, it does happen that you'll have a number of people competing for the same property. I think when we've got to get to a situation where the market is normalised, and that's why the increase in new supply is so important and is something that I'm focusing on as a priority through the delivery of affordable homes. And we're making really good progress on that this year, where we'll see affordable homes for sale this year. And that's very significant for a lot of people who feel that they've been locked out and stuck in a rental trap, frankly.
Yeah. Now, Minister, you want to have the powers to insist that all building on public lands should be social or affordable. Is that your view of the future, that any lands that are publicly owned would be dedicated totally to social and affordable, or is it just that you want flexibility?
No, this pertains to the Land Development Agency bill that's moving through the House right now, Pat. And what I've done is I've brought forward a government amendment that in areas where population over 150,000, so effectively Dublin and Cork, for Land Development Agency land, so that there would be requirements for up to 100% social and affordable to give us that option. And particularly around the affordable area, that we would have up to 80% affordable, because that's where the real demand and the real needs for a whole generation of people who want to actually be able to own their own property at an affordable rate, that's where that demand is. And that's why we're moving really well, actually, and progressing the affordable housing bill, which will be passed by the summer. So we're going to have a national affordable purchase scheme. We're going to have our shared equity scheme in place as well. We're going to have our national affordable rental scheme, which is state-backed rents, you know, at well below market price. So there's going to be real options for a whole cohort of people who feel that they've been forgotten about, and they're not. So what I'm doing with this amendment, Pat, is on Land Development Agency land in Cork and Dublin, and I flagged this when I introduced the bill in the Dáil, was that those lands will be designated 100% affordable and social. So we're looking at in the region of 80 to 90% affordable and 10 to 20% social on those lands. Now, on other lands and other ones, that would be a matter for the local authorities.
Yeah. Now the question of affordable, though, we see the cost of building is rising, and I'm mystified. I heard a builder who's working in the south, but he's from Northern Ireland, saying you could buy a decent 3-bed semi in you know, suburban Northern Ireland for less than 200 grand sterling. And here the costs are astronomical. He said he couldn't afford to buy in the south. What is going on with the cost of building here?
Well, I suppose it depends where in the south he buys, because there are parts of Ireland, as you know as well, where prices would be comparable or lower indeed than certain.
But the block is the block. The double glazed window is the double glazed window. Building materials, but that adds to the cost. I'm just wondering, besides site cost, which can be separated out, you know what the site costs, building in, you know, suburban Dublin should be the same as building in Laois in terms of the cost of materials. So
the cost
what
of
is
material,
going on?
Yes. Well, I think there's a couple of things. We're looking at the annual increase for all materials is about just under 3.5%. But what we've particularly seen through COVID, and even with regard to supply chains, with regard to imports, a large increase in the cost of timber, a very large and substantial increase in the cost of plastic also, and piping, and also in the cost of delivery. We've seen containers that were about $2,000 per container to ship into Ireland rising to $15,000. that was part of the reason for that was the Suez crisis, which is still working its way through. So we've a number of things there. We have to see whether these cost increases are a temporary phenomenon, and we're looking at them really closely because you've had COVID, you've also had Brexit, and then, as I said, we had the supply chain issue that occurred with Suez. So the building costs in the Republic have increased in certain areas quite substantially in the last quarter because of a lack of material. Both China and the US, based on our research, has bought up a lot of timber and a lot of supply. So when I'm talking to people in the construction sector, they're finding it difficult to actually get the required amount of materials that they need, particularly in the area of timber and plastics. And that is posing a problem. Now, we believe this could be a temporary phenomenon based on the three issues that I've raised, and we're watching it very closely. But in relation to material costs, those material costs in Britain as well and in Europe, there has been significant increases in material costs.
We'll keep an eye on what it costs to build a house in Northern Ireland. It should rise proportionately with the cost of materials. And yet it's cheaper, far cheaper than building in suburban Dublin, for example.
Well, I think there's a labour cost issue there as well, Pat, which we do know there is a labour cost. You know that salaries are higher here in the Republic than they are in the North. There's no question about that. But we've got to look at the overall cost of delivery of homes. And that's why the delivery of affordable housing for working people is so important, where the state is getting involved by taking a stake in that home to reduce the price to make sure that home is affordable for people to buy so they have a secure home to live in. So there are interventions we can make. We've the largest housing budget in the history of the state. We're working through it, the largest and most significant affordable housing legislation ever. And that's going to work, and that's really going to help to drive and increase supply, because we need to be building about 33,000 homes a year, Pat, between public and private. Last year was just over 20,000. We don't know what the figure yet will be this year, but we're projecting potentially between 16,000 and 18,000 homes, hopefully a little bit more, but we've been affected by COVID, obviously.
Now, we talked before, Minister.
So there are things we're watching.
We talked before about the strategic housing developments. If it's over 100 apartments or whatever homes, it goes straight to the board. We've learned that the board kind of negotiates with developers in advance of all of these things. And, you know, then, they have pre-planning. Now, the people who live in the locality don't have any pre-planning. They don't have access to the board. And so we've seen again and again that local people have taken judicial reviews against the board, and the board has lost because the board has gone against the county development plan. You know, councillors spend months and months and months producing a county development plan, and the executives of the county councils, and then on board planola just pays no notice at all to what the councillors and the executives have worked so hard to achieve. How is that in any way democratic or transparent?
Well, I think there is a democratic deficit. I've said it on your show before. I'm not a fan of the SHD process in that sense. I understand why it was set up. It was set up in good faith to be able to try to fast-track planning to increase housing need. One of the things when you look through it, though, is how many of the SHD permissions actually are then affected into real construction, and it's quite a low percentage, Pat. So when I look at the judicial reviews that have been taken and decided against the board, we've had about, it is a small proportion of the overall, but still significant. I think what's important is what we do in the future, and I want to just reiterate it, I won't be extending the SHDs. The SHDs will expire in February, and they were extended under the last administration. So they will not continue post February next year. I think what we need to do is further resource and put those resources back into our local authorities and let the local authorities actually deal with the planning on the ground. There is absolutely a role for the board, no question, and people will have a right to appeal to the board or bring cases to the board, and they will do their job there. But the SHD process was, I think, set up in good faith at the time to increase housing supply. That hasn't necessarily been borne out when you look at the results of the planning permissions that are granted, that how many of them turn into actual construction projects.
But the point about the board being able to ignore county development plans, that seems to me to be very
odd. They're supposed to have regard to them, Pat.
That does not mean obey. They can say, we've had regard to the county development plan for Dublin 8, and we're going to allow a 33-storey apartment block beside two-storey red bricks just because we can.
Well, look, I'm Minister with responsibility for planning, so I'm not going to comment on any specific planning application or anything. So forget about government.
No, I wasn't. I was being general, but examples do exist around the place.
Yeah, there are. But just to say this, look, I've said it very clearly. I've said it to you, and we have a commitment in the programme for government not to extend the SHD process, and I won't be doing that. Okay, so we're looking at a number of months that are left. I understand, and many of my colleagues have raised issues with me in their own areas about how they feel that views of residents are not taken into account. Now, can I say this, though? I think it's important in any planning system, if you put SHDs aside for a moment, that it's really important that, you know, people understand that we have a major housing need.
Sure.
And, you know, sometimes that the perfect is the enemy of the good, in the sense that we need to ensure that we're building more homes, and we do get have issues.
No, that's what I think. I get all of that. I do.
Oh, I know understand you do. No, that, I'm just
that you've got to break a few eggs to make the appropriate housing omelet.
Yeah, and we're going to have
just
to do
one.
That.
Yeah, one last question, and it's come up again and again on the programme. Can you ask the minister where all the current renters are going to live when they retire? 65 is young these days, and a lot of 65-year-olds are fit and well. But how can they pay these sky-high rents on a pension? The government is not looking at the future. We would be better off if we were governed from Europe. It's a fundamental question, given how many apartments are being built only for rent now, and people who go into them when they're in the prime of their working life can afford them, but they keep ratcheting up 4% a year, 4% a year for the lifetime of the for their working life. At the end, when they're on a pension, they simply can't afford to stay in their own home.
Well, we're not forgetting about those people, Pat. I've been minister for just coming up to a year. For two things, I'm bringing in quite substantial rental reforms in the autumn. The rent pressure zones will expire this year. That's their 4% increase that you've referenced. And I'm looking at what we can do in that space. I think we have a real opportunity to look towards the continental model of renting. That's why I'm bringing forward the affordable renting, state-backed rents, long-term tenures with below market, substantially below market rents. These will be rents that just cover the cost and maintenance of the development, like what you would have discussed before in your show, the Vienna type model of renting. And we're going to have, you know, about 440 tenancies in place in the next few months. That's just the start of it. So we need to create a new form of rental tenure, which I'm doing under the Affordable Housing Bill. But your texter has raised a very valid point, because people who are retiring are going to see a reduction in their income. Then how can they pay the rent that they're paying there? That's why we need cost rental in place. And that's, again, why we need to have increased housing supply to give other options for people, and options to buy at an affordable rate or to rent long-term at an affordable rate. And I hope in 3-4 years' time, when I'm talking to you, Pat, that we will see, you know, a massive increase in cost rental across the board, that it'll start to become the norm for people, real options for long-term state-backed rents, where you're secure in your home and you're only paying rent that's covering the cost of development and maintenance of that of that development itself. Right. And these are new options,
Minister,
that we're working on.
I look forward to a few conversations in between, as well as one.
We'll have loads. I'll do too, Pat. No problem.
Housing Minister Dara Bryan, thank you very much for joining us.